Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report. And I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are taking a trip north. We are bringing you some recordings from a few interviews I did earlier this summer up in Hyde Park at the Culinary Institute of America. We sat down with the purchasing team there, Brad Matthews and Jeffrey Minard, to talk a little bit about how they make decisions for the culinary school. Really an interesting, beautiful campus. They do a full bachelor's programs for folks in the culinary arts, sending cooks and people working in food out across the country and often the world. Very rigorous program, very big campus. They do a lot of different things up there, from running a multitude of restaurants to the classrooms where students are learning the culinary techniques. So it was interesting to hear a little bit about how, because they're located in the Hudson Valley, they've been able to work towards impacting the local agriculture scene there. Roughly, the Hyde Park campus purchases about $500,000 a year in produce, dairy, eggs, meat, mushrooms, syrup, honey, and more. Although I know there is room to grow that number, and we hope they will. But stay tuned. We're going to be bringing you a conversation we had with Brad and Jeff that will give you a little bit of a behind the scenes of what makes the purchasing world work or not work, and some of the successes and challenges they've had with regards to sourcing locally. So thanks so much. And let's take a listen. All right, you are tuned into the Farm Report, and today we are coming to you from deep in the bowels of the Culinary Institute of America, the CIA. I'm sitting in the office of the Director of Purchasing and Storeroom Operations with Brad Matthews, and stay tuned. We're going to learn a little bit more about how he spends almost $7 million, upwards of $7 million a year bringing food into the program for the students to teach and for folks to eat in the restaurants. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
My name is Brad Matthews. I'm Director of Purchasing and Storeroom Operations at the Culinary Institute.
So, Brad, you started at the CIA at the end of 89?
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about kind of what the purchasing landscape looked like when you first joined the team here.
We had too many vendors of the wrong kind, not enough local people. It was found too hard at that time to find farmers, to find a way to get your needs known in advance. But what I noticed was the quality of the food didn't taste the same as it did from the farms that I grew up surrounded by in this area. And so we made a commitment to, as much as fiscally possible, to expand our support of our neighbors, which keeps more farms in business in the Hudson Valley instead of turning them into strip malls. But it also provided us with a much better product. We used to joke with one of my farmers, you know, product's still warm from the morning sun when it came in here, you know, dew covered, you know.
Yeah, right. Like, that's the ideal.
Right, and it was. I remember one farmer who sadly is no longer with us, he had peaches the size of a softball. and you would hold them, and the juice would bubble up around the stem, and the smell was... And once my chefs found out that we had this guy, they would find out when he was coming, and they would be meeting his truck at the dock. Because that's the quality of produce we could get. And that's what we were after.
Right.
And we went from marginal, sporadic support of farms, usually when they would back a pickup truck up to the dock and ask you, whoever was here, would we take it? And they weren't getting the proper dollar for their product, and we weren't getting the proper product. So we had to make it more business-like, even though it was done in a neighborly, support the local guy.
So, like, what have you seen over the years as, like, some of the other kind of, like, infrastructure tools that have facilitated some of that some of those relationships? Like, are farmers using different communication methods? Is there other players kind of on the field who are supporting that? So he's pulling out his cell phone. Tell me more.
Now farmers are available when you need them. Used to have to get them at 6 in the morning or 6 at night. Or you leave a message on the machine, and if they came in at lunchtime, maybe you would get it. So they didn't know what you needed in advance, and we didn't know if we were getting it in advance. So the cell phone changed the world, but it definitely changed how I was able to work with even my local fishmonger. This is how we communicate. And then now the web, like I told you, that F2T program.
Yeah, so what is F2T for people who aren't familiar?
It's a farm to tables, and this was a woman who was a student here at one time, but got out of cooking and went into selling wine, and then she went into, came up with this idea of connecting with farmers, and on the web, setting them up on the web, so at any time my buyers can go online, see exactly what is available in what quantity and at what price.
Sure.
And then they set up all their orders, and once that order is in, that product is guaranteed you. Whereas before, sometimes you would tell a farmer what you need, and if you had a good day at the farm stand, you might not have gotten your product. This way it's done, it's set, it saves the buyers an incredible amount of time, it saves my dock a huge amount of time, it saves finance and accounts payable and all those things. It makes everything much more efficient.
Right.
And it works better for the farmer because he's spending his time in his field growing what he should be doing and not driving around in his pickup truck banging on the door for money.
Right, exactly.
So that has helped everything. As I told you earlier, what it takes away is that personal, you know, I try to enforce that with my guys, that even though they're buying it through FTT, they need to still talk to those farmers. They still need to have that personal relationship because it just worked better for everybody that way.
Yeah, sure. And I want to be able to kind of paint a picture of the kind of complexity of the operation here at CIA for folks. So can you give us, just in some broad strokes, an outline of kind of what types and what volume of food are kind of coming through the dock here on a kind of daily, weekly basis?
We have everything from basic skills classes right up to white tablecloth restaurants. So the variety, and we also have a full baking program. We have global programs, so we have cuisines of Asia, Mediterranean, the South America, all the Americas. So the variety, the dollar volume here is large. We probably do somewhere around $7 million a year right now. But that's easy. It's the variety.
You know,
we can have 3,000 different SKUs here. And that variety changes and shrinks with the seasons, obviously. We buy more local, more produce during the summer. And then the also challenge is we may need as little as a pound or two of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough to get vendors to want to go too far out of their way to sell you a pound of raw ram.
Right.
So, we have full butcher shop, full fish kitchen, a multitude of bake shops, 5 public restaurants, plus all this range of classes with the pie program where you start in making stocks and learning knife cuts all the way up to the restaurant. So it's we do a graduation every 3 weeks.
Right. So lots of moving parts.
When I first came here, I was probably here 2 years before I wasn't in some minor form of panic. Because it's just so much to grasp. But yeah. What is clear to us is that if we don't do our job right here, mm-hmm. nothing else in this building works.
Yeah, it starts with you.
Right. If we're not putting... Those students pay a great deal of money and invest a great deal of themselves to come here. And if we don't put the right product in front of them when they need it and show them what it's supposed to be, then they're not going to get the chance to work with that product, learn from that product.
Yeah.
So it's rewarding and challenging as hell all the time.
So as we were kind of walking through the produce area, I know we passed a box of tomatoes from McEnroe Farms, which is a farm that I'm familiar with. I know they do sell down at the New York City Green Markets, and you see them around. What for farmers or people who want to be for farmers someday, like what would be your advice to them as someone who leads such a like large scale purchasing operation? Like what helps you kind of work with them? Like what are the tools or the ways to approach if people want to get involved with or think about kind of making entree into more of like an institutional system?
You need to find out what your customers in that area want.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it doesn't matter if you can grow a ton of any one thing well if you can't sell it.
Right.
So you need to find out what the market is, what you can do better than somebody else. I mentioned Sky Farms. His lettuce and his salad mixes are amazing. So that's what he does.
Right.
McEnroe has these phenomenal greenhouses where he has, it looks like a forest inside, and they're tomato plants. So by the time the warm weather comes, he's already got everything growing and ready to go. And so that's his niche.
Right.
So find your niche and then find out which restaurants in your area can support what you do. But also be open to growing what they want.
Right. Right. That makes sense.
The other thing they need to do is be where they say they're going to be when they say they're going to be there. Having an item on my lunch menu doesn't help when the farmer shows up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. Sure, just kind of like basic.
Right. If you know, and that's always been the struggle because they need to be in the field when they need to be in the field. And I understand that. But on the same token, if I promise 3 chefs I will have this product for you on Tuesday morning, it better not show up a Tuesday night.
Right, because there's a lot of wheels turning to like produce in that area. So you had mentioned that you thought you guys were somewhere between like 10 and 15% of like regional procurement. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm wondering if we can talk just briefly about kind of like the produce end of things, I think I understand pretty well. But then I think when you turn around and you're looking at like meat or fish, things become a little bit more complicated ultimately because there's more players involved. You know, there's a slaughter facility. I know you do some butchery here, mm-hmm. But obviously you're not butchering everything you're using in-house.
Most of it.
Oh, really?
Not from quarters and stuff like that, but from primals.
From primals.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of, with your eye towards like meat and fish in particular, like have you seen similar types of changes over the course of your tenure with regards to how you're able to source and who you're able to source from? Or do you think that, like, meat and fish are kind of different than produce?
Fish hasn't changed a whole lot. I have chefs that ask for a 7-pound bass for 6 months. So the response is, it's an ocean, not a shoe store. You know, I mean, we don't grow them. So you got to be what's in the market.
Yeah.
And that will never change. I mean, farmed fish is, you know, aquaculture is changing, and it has to. But there's a local fish farm for now. There's never one before. And we're getting these incredible steelhead trout twice a week, 24 hours out of the water, at a good price.
Right.
So that changed. That much has changed. But some of the older aquaculture fish still doesn't have the flavor or the appeal or the market value that wild striped bass does.
Sure.
So the fish market is you find reputable mongers, people you can trust, know where your fish is coming from, and who can give you the best service. And that's even more important than the price, although with fish, price is very important, but it's getting that service and that trust that, that matters.
Is that because it's so perishable, or...
Yeah. Okay. Perishability. We're fortunate here that we buy all whole ground fish, so the idea of them sneaking other species in and all the stuff you hear in the news, we don't run into that.
Right.
I don't have to worry if it's a red snapper. If I open the box, I know it's a red snapper. So the fish market hasn't really changed much. Things have improved somewhat as to, again, how quickly you can know what's on the boat to getting it here. There are better places, easier places to get fish where that's available without just counting on somebody walking down a punch point and going through the process of hoping something good there in quality.
Right.
Meat has changed in that there are more locals. You know, there's more grass-fed, there's more free-range birds, there's more people raising game birds. And so that has changed somewhat, but the bulk tonnage of my meat, it's still done basically the same.
Same way, yeah. And I guess it's a similar question for people for thinking about, like, proteins and, like, being able to work with proteins on a more regional level. Are there things that you would recommend or like, think, like, oh, man, if we had more regional farmers doing XYZ or being able to supply XYZ?
Being open to what that farmer has. You know, if you want a guy to raise Angus in your area and you want to buy from him, but all you want is a strip loin,
it's tough.
Right.
What's, so what do you with the rest of the cow?
Well, yeah, what are you going to do with the rest of the cow? He needs to move that animal. Now, we don't buy whole animals here, but we do try to support, like, quarters and what we, you know, sometimes our chefs will put it on as market, local market beef. So
a chef can ask specifically for that.
Right.
Okay.
So they can change the preparation on that menu item to what is available at that time. You know, if you want your local to have local grass-fed stuff, then you need to use the whole animal. It sounds obvious, but it's not always the way people see it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I just want ribs and loins. But
yeah. Right.
Then you're going to pay $17,000 for those things, or so the farmer can afford to, you know, practically give away the rest of the animal, or you need to be able to work with the product that's available.
Yeah. I think that's definitely a challenging thing with beef, because I remember that from early in my career. I was working at a corned beef place. I'm like, why don't we just buy all local briskets? And the chef was like, what do they do with the rest of the cow? We go through hundreds of briskets a day. Like, how do you think it works, kid? There's another 1,900 pounds. It's like, oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Open a hamburger stand? And are you, like, what is your engagement with, like, students with regard to, like, how do they learn about purchasing and procurement? What's the, is it, like, how does that work its way into the curriculum?
That is in the curriculum. I don't teach it. There are people here that teach it. One of them was one of my farmers at one time, and he's now teaching product ID here. But our doors are open.
Mm-hmm.
We're not, you know, like a hotel where we lock down the storeroom except for a couple hours a day. Students are in here all the time. Like you heard when you came in, we asked them to leave their bags out front. they walk through, they ask questions, they're available. Jeffrey and Anthony are always fielding questions. They learn the basics of purchasing from their instructors, but they're also welcome on the dock. And you can tell students that are really
into it.
And they understand that you're going to make or break your business at the back door as well as the front. And they're down here watching the dock and watching how they check product and produce and learning about it by just being here.
Right.
And my team here will answer any question to any student. And they all know the dock and they all know the issue.
So if you're a CIA student and you're listening, come down and knock on Brad's door. Oh, man, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turning either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, we are back. In the second half of the show, we are going to be hearing from Jeff Menard. So without further ado, here's that tape. All right, so we're continuing our tour of the CIA. I'm sitting in the basement here with Jeffrey Menard. He is a buyer here at the CIA. His kind of area of purview is non-perishable items, but he also covers a lot of the dairy that's bought by the institution and some of the kind of non-specialty cheese items. So obviously, New York State and this region has a long history as a dairy-producing state. Yes, so does that kind of translate into, I mean, I feel like dairy, especially fluid milk, it's like a perishable item, so by its nature.
You're
kind of looking at local stuff.
Yeah, local stuff. We do a lot with Hudson Valley Fresh, which is a great co-op of local dairy farmers who kind of all merge together and sell their product. Also with Ronnie Brook Farms, we do some of their products as well. And then Feather Ridge Farm for all our shell eggs. We did, I think, 1.5 million shell eggs last year.
Wow.
So it's a quite a large volume.
So I always think it's interesting, like, for someone who's, like, so directly in the buying space. So, like, when you show up, you know, it's Tuesday today, you show up at work, like, can you give us a little bit of a sense of, like, just kind of what your day looks like? What are you reading first thing? What's kind of on your, like, daily to-do list?
Usually I come in, first thing, you know, check your email, see if Chef's looking for something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of put that on the list of things to do for the day. And then we do inventories. Checking the produce truck is first and foremost. They're here usually at 6:45. And then we check all that in and then kind of go about, fill the orders that are maybe missing a product for the chef, do that. And then we kind of do our daily purchasing, doing our orders, talking to vendors, seeing when we're expecting a product, if it's out, just kind of follow up and kind of always keep things moving. It's just, you can't stop. You just got to keep it going forward. It's always something else. There's always something crazy you got to find. And you needed it yesterday, of course, but
sure.
Yeah, you're always running.
Lots of balls in the air. And I think too, just because we're, outside of the city doesn't mean that, like, space still isn't a constraint. So can you talk a little bit about, like, product rotation, especially dealing with something like dairy? Like, how frequently are you getting things in because you can store them or?
Things like dairy, we get our egg delivery about twice a week, which usually contains 40 cases and 30 dozen a case. We get that twice a week. Most of the dairy we can have here between 2 and 3 times a week. If we run short, they're pretty good about bringing us something. But a lot of the local stuff is produced to demand.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when we place our order, it's usually 3 days out from when we need it. So then they basically produce to demand. So it's interesting because we get affected by the public school system that buys the product, because then there's not enough milk that they are using to provide everything else. So it's kind of, we run into a little problem in the summertime, but we make up with other people and it works out.
Yeah. So it's always like a little bit of a balancing act. And then one of the other things, it's like, you're obviously, ensuring kind of the quality of the incoming product. So can you talk a little bit about, like, how do you handle when something's, like, not quite right?
Most of our vendors, if not all of our vendors, if something comes in and we don't think we can use it in the sufficient amount of time, if it looks a little questionable or if it's just questionable at all, we can send it back. We can write a credit. Most of them will gladly replace the product if it comes in and it's questionable. We've had vendors bring us some back later that day. If we get something that we're not happy with, they'll go back and swap out and get us something better that meets our standards.
Yeah.
Which is, it's good. I mean, and that's all building relationships with them over the years, that they know that we're a good customer and we'll continually purchase from them, and they kind of make it right. And
yeah,
it helps a lot.
Well, I think, like, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you're looking for consistency, but you're also dealing with agriculture products.
Mm.
So, like, there's a range, right?
Oh, there is. I mean, and sometimes, I mean, it grows in nature. So, I mean, some weeks, like a beet, it could be the size of a golf ball or the size of a softball, depending upon weeks of growing. And, I mean, you got to kind of make variances and make communications to the kitchen that they know they're going to get large beets as opposed to semi-large beets, so they know how many to use and prepare and what they're looking for. So it's,
I think that, you know, when people think about pursuing a career in culinary, and that, like, purchasing is probably not at the top of most people's lists. It's not necessarily the glamour position,
mm-hmm.
but it's, like, ultimately the decision that is really determining so much of what's allowed to happen at an institution or in a restaurant, because you can't make great food if you don't have good ingredients, and you can't have a sustainable business if you can't hit your food costs. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, like, what types of things, like, drew you to the role and what your background was, kind of like how you got into this.
Oh, it's kind of, I started here, like, growing up, I worked in some delis, grocery store, kind of through high school. And then I came on the CIA in 2001 as just a storeroom clerk working on the floor filling orders. And then I kind of transitioned into the role of purchasing. It's kind of, I have no formal education, just education through working in this industry since I was like 15 years old.
Wow.
Up until now.
So that sounds like a lot of education, actually.
So it's funny because when you say, oh, I'm not formally trained, but then you have the background of working in this food industry and growing up in this area. I mean, you always had farmers markets and the access to good food and good produce in the summertime and stuff like that. So
are there, like, I'm curious, are there, like, I want to say, it's not like buyers clubs, but like it, like in the purchasing kind of like industry, when you go, like, are there kind of trade magazines or conferences or chat boards, or like, is there like a place that like other people in your position in different areas where you kind of, I don't know, exchange?
That's a good one. I haven't really, honestly, haven't explored that.
Yeah.
A lot of it's neat when we go to like food shows, you run into other people that you know from the industry, and they're kind of buyers on different levels. So, I mean, some of our vendors, and then they're buyers, so you get to talk with them a little bit, and it's kind of like you just kind of, just see what's going on and what they have to say, and you kind of, just go that way.
Go that way.
Yeah.
And then thinking about kind of like food, kind of coming back to that conversation around food cost and price, can you talk a little bit about like how you make decisions between kind of the quality, like there's kind of quality and price and relationship and availability. Like, is there a way that you kind of balance those metrics against each other? Or like, if you're going to decide to purchase something like regionally, like how do you decide like where to shift with stuff?
Like, if it's an in-season product, we try to get it from a local farmer, and we'll pay a percentage over what we would normally pay. Just to kind of keep that, it's not I don't know exact percentages, but maybe 20% more on the products. Because, I mean, 99% of the time, I mean, you can't beat the local product. I mean, in taste, flavor, just even quality. I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, it comes out, I know Brad's probably mentioned, comes out of the field sometimes in that morning, and it's at our dock. So
right.
It's, I mean, just to pay that little bit extra for something that you know is going to last, and you know it came from, I mean, sometimes 15 minutes down the road, it's a good... So then that's how we kind of balance it price-wise. And just look at, if it's in season, it's should be a little less expensive than out of season. But, I mean, there are sometimes when we need something that's out of season and it's $11 a pound, and normally in season it's $6 a pound, but chef needs it, you have to make the...
Yeah,
make the call and
the
just let them know that you're paying this X amount of dollars if that's okay with your food cost. And so that's kind of how we do it.
One of the things I hear from, you know, dairy farmers is just the challenge of kind of milk pricing. And I think one of the things that's hard for folks to really wrap their heads around is like the way milk prices are set in this country are really impacted by stuff that's happening all over the world, and that like dairy farmers in particular are like, I like one farmer, she's like, I'm a price taker, not a price maker, which means like she's kind of getting what she gets. She doesn't have much leverage to demand a different price. And so I'm curious on the purchasing side of that, like how often do you see fluctuations if you're looking at dairy prices? And is there a sense, like, is there a seasonal nature to that? Is there shortages that have come up over your tenure where you're like, ah, milk got really expensive? Or, you know, do you track that, like, the way a lot of people track, like, you know, gasoline prices?
We do look at it. Usually, I mean, it's kind of a market thing. I mean, if we see it coming down the line, that there might be a little bump in price, which is kind of good. We do follow some... like trade, and we get a market report of like what we can expect. Even the farmer themselves will be like, listen, we're kind of production's down. We need to kind of juggle the numbers a little bit. And you work with them. I mean, they have to make a living too. So it's like, I mean, you're not going to say, no, we're not going to buy your product.
Sure.
Because they do have a living to make. And then we do, like I said, look at market reports from the government even. I mean, the USDA puts out, like, pricing, commodity pricing and stuff, and a lot of that falls into that, so.
And, like, when you're, like, entering a new buying relationship with someone, I know for an individual restaurant, like, depending on your size, depending on kind of what you're trying to do, you know, you have like different HACCP plans, you need to have different levels of traceability, or to be purchasing from people at different levels of kind of like liability, insurance and whatnot. Do you, when you're purchasing from someone, like what are some of the constraints to that relationship?
We definitely look into that. I mean, the HACCP thing is huge. I mean, a lot of those smaller farmers benefit from like a larger co-op that purchases, because they kind of it limits their liability. It kind of all falls under the big umbrella. So we look at that. Just do a little research. If a new vendor wants to come in, we just kind of do a little background check, a little internet detecting to kind of see if we can find anything about them. Or, I mean, even a lot of vendors come from other vendors that we've done business with, like that they think they might be a good fit for us. So it kind of comes on a recommendation, we'll check them out and go that way. But the HACCP plans and all that, I mean, we just kind of, I mean, with this day and age with everything, and just kind of, you got to be really vigilant and make sure you know where it's coming from and keep track of it.
What is the school? So, I mean, I'm assuming that you guys would fall under the regional like health department here, as far as like, just like a restaurant would get a health department inspection, a similar thing for.
Yes. Yeah, we do. The county comes in, Dutchess County, they have the health inspector comes in, the state comes in, and they do. I mean, we're not exempt from any of that. They check everything. They go through the coolers, take temps, and make sure stuff's stored properly. All the sanitation and hygiene and whatnot is there. I mean, we are a public restaurant. We do have public restaurants, so, I mean, we are serving to the public, so we have to adhere to all that, the same rules and guidelines as everybody else.
What has there been anything, because you're getting to work with chefs who are producing menus from cuisines all over the world, has anything kind of come onto your radar that like now you're buying at home or cooking with or thinking about that you learned about as you bought it? You're like, whoa, what's that?
We used, one of the chefs wanted these long peppercorns. They're like, they almost look like a little pine cone. I know it's kind of hard to explain, but like,
It's like a Balinese long pepper.
And I was like, man, those are crazy. And I tried it. And chef's like, here, just break off a little piece and try it. And I tried it. And I was like, it blew my mind. And then I bought some, and like, it's just one of those things that like, for an added little zip, sometimes you're making something, you just throw a little bit in there to kind of like, just a little, it's a real intense pepper, but it's a pretty wild taste, so.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much. It's been great chatting with you. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you.
All right. That brings us to the end of another episode of The Farm Report. Thank you so much for tuning in. It was great to share some of these recordings with you. A big thanks to Jeff Levine up at the Culinary Institute, who helped coordinate our trip. I went up with a couple of other Heritage hosts. You can look across the network to hear a little bit more of some of the different stuff they have going on up at the CIA. And stay tuned. I have one more set of interviews from our trip that I'll be bringing you later this year. Very interesting stuff from the school's local anthropologists and archaeologists. Kind of unexpected expertise that was really thrilling conversations, and we'll have those episodes for you coming up later in the year. This, of course, like all of the Heritage Radio Network programs, was brought to you with support from our wonderful underwriters and from listeners like you. We really count on your support to keep us on the airwaves. And I would love to see your names on our donor roll. So if you can hear my voice, which I know you can because you're hearing it, it's happening, visit the website. Click that beating heart on the top right-hand corner and drop us a couple of bucks. Show your support. I would love to know that Farm Report listeners are out there and pitching in to keep us on air. Thanks a lot, guys. Stay tuned, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.